Blue Mars, Cassette 8. In the late evening, people dispersed. Francis walked with Michelle over to the Roman arena, and they climbed the bowed stone steps of the medieval towers that had fortified the arena. From the little stone chamber at the top of the stairs, they looked out small windows at the tile roofs and the treeless streets and the Rhone. Out the south windows, they could see a portion of the speckled sheet of water which was the Camargue. "Back on the Med," Francis said, deeply satisfied. "The flood may have been a disaster for most places, but for Arles it has been a veritable coup. The rice farmers are all coming into town ready to fish or take any work they can get, and many of the boats that survived have been docked right here in town. They've been bringing fruit in from Corsica and Majorca, trade with Barcelona and Sicily. We've taken a good bit of Marseille's business, although they're recovering quickly, it has to be said. But what life has come back! Before, you know, X had the university, Marseille had the sea, and we had only these ruins and the tourists who came for a day to see them. And tourism is an ugly business. It's not fit work for human beings. It's hosting parasites. But now we're living again." He was a little bit drunk. "Here, you must come out on the boat with me and see the lagoon. I'd like that." That night, Michelle called Maya again. "You must come. I found my nephew, my family." Maya wasn't impressed. "Nergal went to England looking for Hiroko," she said sharply. "Someone told him she was there, and he left just like that." "What's this?" Michelle exclaimed, shocked by the sudden intrusion of the idea of Hiroko. "Oh, Michelle, you know it can't be true. Someone said it to Nergal, that's all it was. It can't be true, but he ran right off." "As would I." "Please, Michelle, don't be stupid. One fool is enough. If Hiroko is alive at all, then she's on Mars. Someone just said this to Nergal to get him away from the negotiations. I only hope it was for nothing worse. He was having too much of an effect on people, and he wasn't watching his tongue. You should call him and tell him to come back. Maybe he would listen to you." "I wouldn't if I were him." Michelle was lost in thought, trying to crush the sudden hope that Hiroko was alive. And in England, of all places. Alive anywhere. Hiroko, and therefore Iwao, Jean, Raya, the whole group, his family, his real family. He shuddered hard, and when he tried to tell the impatient Maya about his family in Arles, the words stuck in his throat. His real family had all disappeared 4 years before, and that was the truth. Finally, sick at heart, he could only say, "Please, Maya, please come." "Soon. I've told Sachs I'll go as soon as we're finished here. That will leave all the rest of it to him, and he can barely talk. It's ridiculous." She was exaggerating. They had a full diplomatic team there, and Sachs was perfectly competent, in his way. "But okay, okay, I'm going to do it, so stop pestering me." She came the next week. Michelle drove to the new train station and met her, feeling nervous. He had lived with Maya in Odessa and Burroughs for almost 30 years, but now, driving her to Avignon, she seemed like a stranger sitting there beside him, an ancient beauty with hooded eyes and an expression hard to read, speaking English in harsh, rapid sentences, telling him everything that had happened in Bern. They had a treaty with the UN which had agreed to their independence. In return, they were to allow some emigration, but no more than 10% of the Martian population per year, some transfer of mineral resources, some consultation on diplomatic issues. "That's good, really good." Michelle tried to concentrate on her news, but it was hard. Occasionally, as she spoke, she glanced at the buildings shooting past their car, but in the dusty, windy sunlight, they looked tawdry enough in all truth. She didn't seem impressed. With a sinking feeling, Michel drove as close as he could to the Pope's palace in Avignon, parked, and took her for a walk along the swollen river, past the bridge that didn't reach to the other side, then to the wide promenade leading south from the palace, where sidewalk cafes nestled in the shade of the ancient plane trees. There they ate lunch, and Michel tasted the olive oil and the cassis, running them luxuriously over his tongue as he watched his companion relax into her metal chair like a cat. "This is nice," she said, and he smiled. It was nice. Cool, relaxed, civilized, the food and drink very fine. But for him, the taste of cassis was unleashing its flood of memories, emotions from previous incarnations blended with the emotions he felt now, heightening everything. Colors, textures, the feel of metal chairs and wind. While for Maya, cassis was just a tart berry drink. It occurred to him as he watched her that fate had led him to a companion even more attractive than the beautiful French women he had consorted with in that earlier life, a woman somehow greater. In that, too, he had done well on Mars. He had taken on a bigger life. This feeling and his nostalgia clashed in his heart, and all the while Maya swallowed mouthfuls of cassoulet, wine, cheeses, cassis, coffee, oblivious to the interference pattern of his lives moving in and out of phase inside him. They talked desultorily. Maya was relaxed, enjoying herself, happy at her accomplishment in Bern, in no hurry to go anywhere. Michel felt a glow like a Meggendorf all through him. Watching her, he was slowly becoming happy himself, simply happy. Past, future, neither was ever real. Just lunch under plane trees in Avignon. No need to think of anything but that. "So civilized," Maya said. "I haven't felt so calm in years. I can see why you like it." And then she was laughing at him, and he could feel an idiot grin plastering his face. "Would you not like to see Moscow again?" he asked curiously. "Ah, no. I would not." She dismissed the idea as an intrusion on the moment. He wondered what she felt about this return to Earth. Surely one couldn't be completely without feelings about such a thing. But to some people, home was home, a complex of feeling far beyond rationality, a sort of grid or gravitational field in which the personality itself took its geometrical shape. While for others, a place was just a place, and the self free of all that, the same no matter where it was. One kind lived in the Einsteinian curved space of home, the other in the Newtonian absolute space of the free self. And while he was one of the former type, Maya was one of the latter, and there was no use struggling against that fact. Nevertheless, he wanted her to like Provence, or at least to see why he loved it. And so, when they were done eating, he drove her south through Saint-Rémy to Les Baux. She slept during the drive, and he was not displeased. Between Avignon and Les Baux, the landscape consisted mostly of ugly industrial buildings scattered on a dusty plain. She woke up at just the right time when he was negotiating the narrow, twisting road that wandered up a crease in the Alpes to the old hilltop village. One parked in a parking lot, then walked up into the town. It was clearly a tourist arrangement, but the single curving street of the little settlement was now very quiet indeed, as if abandoned, and very picturesque. The village was shuttered for the afternoon, asleep. On the last turn to the hill's top, one crossed open ground like a rough tilted plaza, and beyond that were the limestone knobs of the hilltop. Every knob hollowed out by some eremite of the ancient hermitage, tucked above Saracens and all the other dangers of the medieval world. To the south, the Mediterranean gleamed like gold plate. The rock itself was yellowish, and as a thin veil of bronzed cloud lay in the western sky, the light everywhere took on a metallic amber cast, as if they walked in a gel of years. They clambered from one tiny chamber to the next, marveling at how small they were. "It's like a prairie dog nest," Maya said, peering down into one squared-out little cave. "It's like our trailer park in Underhill." Back on the tilted plaza, littered with limestone blocks, they stopped to watch the Mediterranean shine. Michel pointed out the lighter sheen of the Camargue. You used to see only a little bit of water. The light deepened to a dark apricot, and the hill seemed a fortress above the oh-so-spacious world, above time itself. Maya put an arm around his waist and hugged him, shivering. It's beautiful, but I couldn't live up here like they did. It's too exposed somehow. They went back to Arles. As it was a Saturday night, the town center had become a kind of gypsy or North African festival, the alleys crowded with food and drink stands, many of them tucked into the arches of the Roman arena, which was open to all, with a band playing inside it. Maya and Michel walked around arm in arm, bathed in the smells of frying food and Arabic spices. Voices around them spoke in two or three different languages. "It reminds me of Odessa," Maya said as they made their promenade around the Roman arena. "Only the people are so little. It's nice not to feel dwarfed for once." They danced in the arena center, drank at a table under the blurry stars. One star was red, and Michel had his suspicions, but didn't voice them. They went back to his hotel room and made love on the narrow bed, and at some point it seemed to Michel that there were several people in him, all coming at once. He cried out at the strange rapture of that sensation. Maya fell asleep, and he lay beside her awake, in a tristesse reverberating somewhere outside time, drinking in the familiar smell of her hair and listening to the slowly diminishing cacophony of the town. Home at last. In the days that followed, he introduced her to his nephew and to the rest of his relatives, rounded up by Francis. The whole gang took her in and, through the use of translation AIs, asked her scores of questions. They also tried to tell her everything about themselves. It happened so often, Michel thought. People wanted to seize the famous stranger whose story they knew, or thought they knew, and give them their story in return, to redress the balance of the relationship. Some kind of witnessing or confessional. The reciprocal sharing of stories. And people were naturally drawn to Maya anyway. She listened to their stories and laughed and asked questions, utterly there. Time after time they told her how the flood had come, drowning their homes, their livings, throwing them out into the world, to friends and family they hadn't seen in years, forcing them into new patterns and reliances, breaking the mold of their lives and thrusting them out into the Mistral. They had been exalted by this process, Michel saw. They were proud of their response, of how people had pulled together, also very indignant at any counterexamples of gouging or callousness, blots on an otherwise heroic affair. Can you believe it? And it did no good. He was jumped one night in the street and all that money gone. It woke us up, do you see? Do you see? It woke us up when we had been asleep forever. They would say these things to Michel in French, watch him nod, and then watch Maya for her response as the AIs told their tale in English to her. And she would nod as well, absorbed as she had been in the young natives around Hellas Basin, focusing their stories by the look on her face, by her interest. Ah, she and Nergal, they were two of a kind. They were charismatics because of the way they focused on others, the way they exalted people's stories. Perhaps that was what charisma was, a kind of mirror quality. Some of Michel's relatives took them out on their boats, and Maya marveled at the rampaging Rhone as they ran down it, at the strangely cluttered lagoon of the Camargue, and the efforts people were making to rechannelize it. Then out onto the brown water of the Med, and farther still onto the blue water, the sun-beaten blue, the little boat bouncing over the white caps whipped up by the Mistral. All the way out of the sight of land, on a blue, sun-beaten plate of water. Amazing. Michel stripped and jumped over the side into cold water, where he sloshed the salt water down and drank some of it, too, savoring the amniotic taste of his old beach swims. Back on land, they went out on drives. Once they went out to see the Pont du Gard, and there it was, same as ever, the Romans' greatest work of art, an aqueduct. three tiers of stone, the thick lower arches four square in the river, proud of their 2,000 years' resistance to running water, lighter, taller arches above, then the smallest on top of them, form following function right into the heart of the beautiful, using stone to take water over water. The stone now pitted and honey blonde, very Martian in every respect. It looked like Nadia's Underhill arcade, standing there in the dusty green and limestone gorge of the Gard, in Provence. But now to Michel, almost more Mars than France. Maya loved its elegance. See how human it is, Michel? This is what our Martian structures lack. They're too big, but this was built by human hands, with tools anyone could construct and use. Block and tackle and human math, and perhaps some horses. And not our teleoperated machines and their weird materials doing things no one can understand or even see. Yes. I wonder if we could build things by hand. Nadia should see this. She would love it. That's what I thought. Michel was happy. They ate a picnic there. They visited the fountains of Aix-en-Provence, went out to an overlook above the Grand Canyon of the Gard, nosed around the street docks of Marseille, visited the Roman sites in Orange and Nîmes, drove past the drowned resorts of the Côte d'Azur, walked out one evening to Michel's ruined mât and into the middle of the old olive grove. And every night of these few precious days they returned to Arles and ate in the hotel restaurant, or if it was warm out, under the plane trees in the sidewalk cafes, and then went up to their room and made love, and at dawn woke and made love again, or went down directly for fresh croissant and coffee. "It's lovely," Maya said, standing one blue evening in the tower of the arena, looking over the tile roofs of the town. She meant all of it. All of Provence, and Michel was happy. But a call came on the wrist. Nergal was sick, very sick. Sachs, sounding shaken, had already gotten him off Earth back into Martian G in a sterile environment inside a ship in Terran orbit. "I'm afraid his immune system isn't up to it, and the G doesn't help. He's got an infection, pulmonary edema, a very bad fever." "Allergic to Earth," Maya said, her face grim. She made plans and ended the call with curt instructions to Sachs to stay calm, then went to the room's little closet and began to throw her clothes out onto the bed. "Come on," she cried when she saw Michel standing there. "We have to go." "We do?" She waved him off, burrowed into the closet. "I'm going." She threw handfuls of underwear into her suitcase, gave him a look. "It's time to go anyway." "It is?" She didn't reply. She was tapping at her wrist pad, asking the local Praxis team to arrange transport into space. There they would rendezvous with Sachs and Nergal. Her voice was cold, tense, businesslike. She had already forgotten Provence. When she saw Michel still standing motionless, she exploded. "Oh, come on, don't be so theatrical about it. Just because we have to leave now doesn't mean we won't ever come back. We're going to live 1,000 years. You can come back all the time, if you want. 100 times. My God. Besides, how is this place so much better than Mars? It looks just like Odessa to me, and you were happy there, weren't you?" Michel ignored that. He stumbled by her suitcases to the window. Outside, an ordinary Arlesian street, blue in the twilight. Pastel stucco walls. Cobblestones. Cypress trees. Tiles on the roof across the street were broken. Mars-colored. Voices below shouted in French, angry about something. "Well," Maya exclaimed, "are you coming?" Yes. Part 6. Anne in the Outback. Look, not choosing to take the longevity treatment is suicide.
So?
Well, suicide is usually considered to be a sign of psychological dysfunction.
Usually.
I think you'll find it's true more often than not. You're unhappy, at least.
At least.
And yet why? What now is lacking?
The world.
Every day you still walk out to see the sunset.
Habit.
You claim the destruction of the primal Mars is the source of your depression. I think the philosophical reasons cited by people suffering depression are masks protecting them from harder, more personal hurts.
It can all be real.
You mean all the reasons?
Yes.
What did you accuse Sachs of? Monocausal taxophilia? Touché. But there's usually a start to these things, among all the real reasons, the first one that started you down your road. Often you have to go back to that point in your journey in order to start off in a new way.
Time is not space. The metaphor of space lies about what is really possible in time. You can never go back.
No, no. You can go back, metaphorically. In your mental traveling, you can journey back into the past, retrace your steps, see where you turned and why, then proceed onward in a direction that's different because it includes these loops of understanding. Increased understanding increases meaning. When you continue to insist that it is the fate of Mars that concerns you most, I think it's a displacement so strong that it has confused you. It, too, is a metaphor. Perhaps a true one, yes. But both terms of the metaphor should be recognized.
I see what I see.
But the way it is, you are not even seeing. There is so much of red Mars that remains. You should go out and look. Go out and empty your mind and just see what's out there. Go out at low altitude and walk free in the air. A simple dust mask only. It would be good for you. Good at the physiological level. Also, it would be reaping a benefit of the terraforming. To experience the freedom it gives us, the bond with this world, that we can walk on its surface naked and survive. It's amazing. It makes us part of an ecology. It deserves to be rethought, this process. You should go out to consider it, to study the process as aeroformation.
That's just a word. We took this planet and plowed it under. It's melting under our feet.
Melting in native water. Not imported from Saturn or the like. It's been there from the beginning, part of the original accretion, right? Outgassed from the first lump that was Mars. Now part of our bodies. Our very bodies are patterns in Martian water. Without the trace minerals, we would be transparent. We are Martian water. And water that has been on the surface of Mars before, yes? Rupturing out in Artesian apocalypse. Those channels are so big.
It was permafrost for 2 billion years.
Then we helped it back onto the surface. The majesty of the great outbreak floods. We were there. We saw one with our own eyes. We nearly died in it. Yes, yes. You felt the car as that water swept it away. You were driving. Yes, but it swept Frank away instead. Yes, it swept the world away and left us on the beach. The world is still here. You could go out and see.
I don't want to see. I've seen it already.
Not you. Some previous you. Now you're the you living now.
Yes, yes.
I think you're afraid. Afraid of attempting a transmutation, a metamorphosis into something new. The alembic stands out there, all around you. The fire is hot. You'll be melted. You'll be reborn. Who knows if you'll still be there afterward?
I don't want to change.
You don't want to stop loving Mars.
Yes, no.
You will never stop loving Mars. After metamorphosis, the rock still exists. It's usually harder than the parent rock, yes? You will always love Mars. Your task becomes seeing the Mars that always endures, under thick or thin, hot or cold, wet or dry. Those are ephemeral, but Mars endures. These floods happened before, isn't it true?
Yes.
Mars's own water. All these volatiles are Mars's own volatiles.
Except the nitrogen from Titan.
Yes, yes, you sound like Sachs.
Come on.
You two are more alike than you think, and all we volatiles are Mars's own.
but the destruction of the surface. It's wrecked. Everything's changed.
That's areology, or the areophany.
It's destruction. We should have tried living here as it was.
But we didn't.
And so now being red means working to keep conditions as much like the primal conditions as possible within the framework of the areophany, the project of biosphere creation that allows humans the freedom of the surface below a certain altitude. That's all being a red can mean now. And there are a lot of reds like that. I think you worry that if you ever change in even the slightest degree, then that will be the end of redness everywhere. But redness is bigger than you. You helped start it and define it, but you were never the only one. If you had been, no one would ever have listened to you. They didn't. Some did. Many did. Redness will go on no matter what you do. You could retire, you could become someone entirely different, you could become lime green, and redness would always go on. It might even become something more red than you ever imagined. I've imagined it as red as it can get. All those alternatives. We'll live one of them, and then go on. The process of co-adaptation with this planet will go on for thousands of years, but here we are now. At every moment you should ask, what now is lacking? And work at some acceptance of your current reality. This is sanity. This is life. You have to imagine your life from here on out. I can't. I've tried, and I can't.
You should go have a look around, really.
A walk about. Look very closely. Take a look even at the ice seas. A close look. But not just that.
That is in the nature of a confrontation.
Confrontation is not necessarily bad, but first, just a look, eh? A recognition.
Then you should think about going up into the hills. Tharsis, Elysium.
A rise in altitude is a voyage into the past. Your task is to find the Mars that endures through all. It's wonderful, really. So many people don't have such a wonderful task as that, you can't imagine. You're lucky to have it. And you?
What?
What is your task?
My task?
Yes. Your task.
I'm not sure. I told you I envy you having that. My tasks are confused. To help Maya and me, and the rest of us.
Reconciliation.
I would like to find Hiroko.
You've been our shrink for a long time.
Yes.
Over 100 years.
Yes.
And never any results at all.
Well, I like to think I have helped a little.
But it doesn't come naturally to you.
Perhaps not.
Do you think people get interested in studying psychology because they're troubled in the mind?
It's a common theory.
But no one has ever been shrink to you.
Oh, I've had my therapists.
Helpful?
Yes, quite helpful.
Fairly helpful. I mean, they did what they could. But you don't know your task.
No, or I want to go home.
What home?
That's the problem. Hard when you don't know where your home is, eh?
Yes. I thought you would stay in Provence.
No. I mean, Provence is my home,
but now you're on your way back to Mars.
Yes.
You decided to come back?
Yes.
You don't know what you're doing, do you?
No. But you do. You know where your home is.
You have that, and it's precious. You should remember that.
You shouldn't be throwing away such a gift, or thinking it's a burden.
You're a fool to think that.
It's a gift, damn you, a precious, precious gift, do you understand me?
I'll have to think about that.
He left the refuge in a meteorological rover from the previous century, a high square thing with a luxurious window box driver's compartment up top. It wasn't unlike the front half of the expedition rover in which she had first traveled to the North Pole with Nadia and Phyllis and Edmund and George.
And because she had spent thousands of days since then in such machines, she at first had the impression that what she was doing was ordinary, contiguous with the rest of her life. But she drove northeast, down canyon, until she was in the bed of the little unnamed channel at 60 degrees longitude, 53 degrees north. This valley had been carved by a small aquifer outbreak during the late Amazonian, running in an earlier Graben fault down the lower slopes of the Great Escarpment. The scoring effects of the flood were still visible on the rims of the canyon walls and in the lenticular islands of bedrock on the floor of the channel, which now ran north into a sea of ice. She got out of the car wearing a fiber-filled windsuit, a CO2 mask, goggles, and heated boots. The air was thin and cold, though it was spring now in the north, LS-10 M53. Cold and windy, ragged lines of low puffy clouds racing east. It was either going to be an ice age or, if the Greens' manipulations forestalled it, then a year without summer like 1810 on Earth, when the explosion of the volcano Tambori had chilled the world. She walked the shore of the new sea. It was at the foot of the Great Escarpment in Tempe Terra, a lobe of ancient highlands extending into the north. Tempe had probably escaped the general stripping of the northern hemisphere by being roughly opposite the impact point of the big hit, which most areologists now agreed had struck near Hrad Vallis above Elysium. So, battered hills overlooking an ice-covered sea. The rock looked like a Red Sea's surface in a wild cross-chop. The ice looked like a prairie in the depths of winter. Native water, as Michel had said, there from the beginning, on the surface before. It was a hard thing to grasp. Her thoughts were scattered and confused, darting this way and that all at the same time. It was like madness, but not. She knew the difference. The hum and keen of the wind didn't speak to her in the tones of the MIT lecturer. She suffered no choking sensations when she tried to breathe. It wasn't like that. Rather, her thinking was accelerated, fractured, unpredictable, like that flock of birds over the ice, zigzagging across the sky in a hard wind from the west. Ah, the feel of that same wind against her body, shoving at it, the new thick air like a great animal paw. The birds struggled in it with reckless skill. She stood for a while and watched. They were skuas, out hunting over the dark streaks of open water. These polynyas were just the surface signs of immense pods of liquid water under the ice. She had heard that a continuous channel of under-ice water now wrapped the globe, winding east over old Vastatas, tearing frequent polynyas in the surface, gaps which then stayed liquid for an hour or a week. Even with the air so cold, the underwater temperatures were warmed by the drowned Vastatas moholes and rising heat from the thousands of thermonuclear explosions set off by the metanats around the turn of the century. These bombs had been placed deep enough in the mega-regolith to trap their radioactive fallout, supposedly, but not their heat, which rose in a thermal pulse through the rock, a pulse that would continue for years and years. No. Michel could talk about it being Mars's water, but there was little else that was natural about this new sea. Anne hiked up a ridge to get a wider view. There it lay. Ice, mostly flat, sometimes shattered. All as still as a butterfly on a twig, as if the whiteness might suddenly lift off and fly away. The birds wheeling and the clouds scudding showed how hard the wind blew, everything in the air pouring east, but the ice remained still. The wind's voice was deep and huge, scraping over a billion cold edges. A strip of gray water was striated by wind chop, the strength of each gust precisely registered by the flayed cat's paws, each brush of harder wind feathering the larger waves with exquisite sensitivity. Water. And below that brushed surface, plankton, krill, fish, squid. She had heard they were producing in hatcheries all the creatures of the extremely short Antarctic food chain and then releasing them to the sea. Teeming water. The skuas wheeled overhead. One cloud of them whirlpooled down onto something along on the shore, behind some rocks. Anne hiked toward them. Suddenly she saw the bird's target lying in a cleft at the edge of the ice, the mostly eaten remains of a seal. Seals! The corpse lay on tundra grass, in the lee of a patch of sand dunes, sheltered by another rocky ridge running down into the ice. The white skeleton emerged from dark red flesh, ringed by white blubber, black fur, all torn open to the sky, eyes pecked out. She hiked on past the corpse, up another little ridge. The ridge made a kind of cape extending into the ice, and beyond it was a bay, a round bay, a crater infilled by ice. It had happened to lie at sea level, had happened to have a breach in its rim on its seaward side so that water and ice had poured in and filled it. Now a round bay, perfect for a harbor. One day it would be a harbor, about 3 kilometers across. Anne sat down on a boulder on the cape and looked out at the new bay. Her breath heaved in and out of her in an involuntary motion, her ribcage moving violently as during labor contractions. Sobs, yes. She pulled aside her face mask, blew her nose using her finger, wiped her eyes, all the while still weeping furiously. This was her body. She recalled the first time she had stumbled onto the flooding of Vastatas in a solo trip ages ago. That time she hadn't cried, but Michelle had said that was only shock, the numbness of shock, as in any injury, withdrawal from her body and her feelings. Michelle would call this response healthier, no doubt, but why? It hurt. Her body spasming in a seismic trembling. But when it was over, Michelle would say, she would feel better. Drained. A tension gone. The tectonics of the limbic system. She scorned such simplistic analogies as Michelle offered. The woman as planet. It was absurd. Nevertheless, there she sat, sniffling, looking out at the ice bay under scudding clouds, feeling drained. Nothing moved except for clouds overhead and cat's paws on a patch of open water, gust after gust, shimmering gray, mauve, gray. Water moved, but the land was still. Finally, Anne stood and walked down a rib of hard old Shishovite, now forming a narrow divide between two long beaches. To tell the truth, above the ice, there wasn't that much that had changed from the primal state. Down at the waterline, it was a different story. Here, the daily trade winds over the open water of the summer bay had created waves large enough to break the remaining chunks of ice into what they called brash ice. Lines of this flotsam were now beached above the current ice level, like ice sculptures depicting driftwood. But in the summer, this ice had helped to rip up the sand of the new beaches, tearing it into a slurry of ice and mud and sand, now frozen in place like brown cake frosting. Anne walked slowly across this mess. Beyond it, there was a little inlet, crowded with ice boulders that had grounded in the shallows and then been frozen into the sea surface. Exposure to sun and wind had rendered these boulders into baroque fantasias of clear blue ice and opaque red ice, like aggregates of sapphire and bloodstone. The south sides of the blocks had melted preferentially, the meltwater frozen in icicles, ice beards, ice sheets, ice columns. Looking back at the shore, she saw again how the sand was furrowed and torn. The damage was terrific. The gouges, sometimes 2 meters deep, incredible force to plow such trenches. The sand drifts must have been loess made of loose light aeolian deposits. Now, a no-man's land of frozen mud and dirty ice, as if bombs had devastated some sad army's trenches. She continued outward, stepping on opaque ice, on the surface of the bay, like a world covered in semen. Once the ice cracked under her boot. When she was well out on the bay, she stopped and had a look around. Tight horizons indeed. She climbed a flat-topped berg, which gave her a larger view over the expanse of ice, out to the circle of the crater rim, just under the running clouds.
Though cracked and jumbled and lined by pressure ridges, the ice nevertheless clearly conveyed the flatness of the water beneath it. To the north, the gap to the sea was obvious. Tabular bergs stuck out from the ice like deformed castles, a white waste. After struggling to come to grips with the scene and failing, she clambered off the berg and hiked back to the shore, then back toward her car. As she was crossing the little ridge cape, movement down at the edge of the ice caught her eye. A white thing moved. A person in a white walker on all fours? No. A bear. A polar bear, walking along the edge of the ice. It spotted the dust devil of skuas over the dead seal. Anne crouched behind a boulder, went prone on a patch of frosty sand, cold all along the front of her body. She looked over the boulder. The bear's ivory fur yellowed on its flanks and legs. It raised a heavy head, sniffed like a dog, looked around curiously. It shambled to the corpse of the seal, ignoring the column of squealing birds. It ate from the seal like a dog from a bowl. It raised its head, muzzle dark red. Anne's heart pounded. The bear sat on its haunches and licked a paw, rubbed its face until it was clean, cat-like in its fastidiousness. Then, without warning, it dropped to all fours and started up the slope of rock and sand toward Anne's hiding place behind the boulder. It trotted, moving both the legs on one side of its body in the same motion. Left, right, left. Anne rolled down the other side of the little cape and got up and ran up the trough of a shallow fracture, leading her southwest. Her rover was almost directly west of her, she reckoned, but the bear was coming from the northwest. She clambered up the short, steep side of the southwest trending canyon, ran over a strip of high ground to another little fracture canyon, trending a bit more to the west than the previous one. Up again onto the next strip of high ground between these shallow fossae. She looked back. Already she was panting, and her rover was still at least 2 kilometers away, to the west and a little south. It was still out of sight behind ragged hillocks. The bear was north and east of her. If it made directly for the rover, it would be almost as close to it now as she was. Did it hunt by sight or by smell? Could it plot the course of its prey and move to cut it off? No doubt it could.
This ends side 1 of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.